My God, the shrieking and pounding up and down the halls. It goes on till all hours.
Are you still in touch with Marla?
Now and then. She remarried. Last I heard, she's still in Louisville somewhere. I'd like to go back and see her as soon as I'm done with this. I want to see my daughter, too, and make it up to her. I know I haven't been a good father. I was too busy screwing up, but I'd like to try. I want to see my mother, too.
Your mother's still alive? I asked, incredulous.
Sure, she's 85, but she's as tough as they come.
Not that it's any of my business, but how old are you?
65. Old enough to retire if I ever had a real job.
So you were released fairly recently, I said.
About 3 weeks ago. I went from Ashland to 6 months in a halfway house. Soon as I was sprung, I headed for the coast. I wrote to Johnny in April and gave him my release date. He said to come ahead, he'd help me out. So that's what I did. The rest is just like I told you before. I didn't know he was dead until I knocked on Bucky's door.
What kind of help was Johnny talking about?
Rawson shrugged. Place to stay, a stake. He had some ideas about a little business we could run. I worked in the joint. Every able-bodied inmate works. But I was only earning 40 cents an hour, out of which I had to pay for my own candy bars, soda pop, and deodorant, stuff like that. So it's not like I had any kind of savings built up.
How'd you pay for travel getting out here?
My mother lent me the money. I said I'd pay her back.
Who's the guy who broke into Johnny's place?
His name is Gilbert Hayes, a former cellie of mine. He's a guy I did time with a couple of years ago. I shot off my big mouth trying to impress the crud. Don't ask why. He's such a cocky piece of excrement, I'm still kicking myself.
His grimace opened up the split in his lower lip. A line of blood welled out. He pressed a paper napkin to his mouth.
Shot your mouth off about what? Look, we're in the joint. What do any of us have to do except BS each other? He was always bragging about something, so I told him about Johnny. The guy was a miser, always squirreling cash away. Johnny didn't come right out and say so, but he used to hint he had big bucks hidden on the property.
You were going to rip him off?
Not me. Hey, come on, I wouldn't do that to him. We were just telling tall tales. Later, Hayes and me had a falling out. He probably figured he could pick up a wad of cash and I'd never know the difference.
You told him where Johnny lived?
California is all I said. He must have followed me across country, the slimy son of a bitch.
How'd he know you'd been released?
Now that I don't know. He might have talked to my P.O. I seem to recall I might have threatened him once upon a time. He probably told him he was worried I'd come after him, which I still might.
How did you figure out it was him?
I didn't at first. Minute I heard about the break-in, I knew something was off, but I didn't think about Hayes. Then I realized what happened, and, like, it had to be him. Simple process of elimination, because I never breathed a word about Johnny to anyone else.
Ray lifted the napkin away from his bleeding lip.
How's that?
Well, it isn't gushing, I said. Can we back up a bit? Once you heard Johnny was dead, what made you so sure he still had money stashed somewhere?
I wasn't sure, but it just made sense. Guy drops dead of a heart attack, he doesn't have time to do anything. Talking to Bucky, I realized the kid didn't have a dime, so if there's money, it's probably still hidden somewhere on the premises. I figure if I rent his place, I can look around at my leisure.
Meanwhile, you didn't say a word to Bucky about this.
About the money? No way. You know why? Suppose I'm wrong. Why get their hopes up if there's nothing? If I do find some money, I can ask for a cut.
Oh, right. This is money they don't know anything about, and you're telling me you'd turn it over to them? He smiled sheepishly.
I might skim off a small percentage, but what harm would that do? They're still going to come up with more than they ever had reason to expect.
And in the meantime, this former cellmate's followed you to Johnny's door.
That's my guess.
How'd he know about the kick plate?
Ray held up his battered hand. Because I told him. Otherwise, he'd have broken every bone in my hand. He had me at a disadvantage because I wasn't expecting him. Next time I'll know, and one of us is going to end up dead.
How did you know about the kick plate? Ray tapped himself on the temple. I know how Johnny's mind worked. The day I came up there and you were looking through his books, I was doing a little survey. He'd used a kick plate before. This was way back when, so I was thinking I'd try that first. He stirred in his seat. You don't believe me. I can tell by the look on your face. I smiled slightly. You're a very slick man. You lie about as well as I do, only you've had more practice. He started to say something, but the waitress had reappeared with two steaming plates on a tray. She looked harried, to say the least. She set down juice, two side orders of buttered toast, and a variety of jams. She took a couple of small paper packets from the pocket of her uniform and put them by his plate. I got you these, she said. Ray picked up a packet. What's my doll? For cramps, but it'll cure anything that ails you. Just don't take too many. You might develop PMS. PMS? He said blankly. Neither of us responded. Let him figure it out. She refilled our coffee cups and moved on to another table, taking out her order pad. Ray opened a paper packet and tossed back two tablets with his orange juice. We spent a short, intense spell shoveling food down our throats. Rawson finally dabbed a paper napkin gingerly across his lips. You want my suggestion? I'd say let's quit hassling what's past and figure out what comes next. Ah, now we're partners. The buddy system, I said. Sure, why not? Gilbert Hayes took Johnny's money and I want it back. This is not just for me. I'm talking about Bucky and Chester. Isn't that why they hired you? To return what Hayes stole? I suppose, I said. He shrugged laconically. So how about it, then? What's the plan? How come it's up to me? You think of one, I said. You're the one getting paid. I'm just here to assist. I studied him, debating the garbled tale he'd just told. I didn't really believe he was telling me the truth, but I didn't know him well enough to know what kinds of lies he told. Actually, there is one possibility, and I could use some help, I said. Good, what's the deal? I took out Laura's room key and placed it on the table. I have the key to Laura Huckabee's room. His face went completely blank, and then his brow was furrowed by a squint. He leaned forward, staring. He said, What? The woman with the duffel. She's using the name Hudson, but that's the key to her room. Chapter 10 I hauled one of the linen carts out of the utility alcove on Laura Huckabee's floor. I had changed into my red uniform again, ready to go to work. I pulled a stack of clean sheets and towels from the shelf in the linen room and put them on my cart, adding boxes of tissues, toilet paper, toiletries, and the laminated Made in Room sign I'd snitched before. I checked the clipboard attached to the cart on one end. A ballpoint pen was affixed to the clipboard with a tatty piece of string. None of the rooms had been done as far as I could see. Bernadette and Eileen were listed on the worksheet, but none of their duties had been checked off as yet. I wasn't sure what would happen if one of them showed up in the midst of my faux labors. Surely nobody would object to my pitching in, unless these women got territorial about toilet bowls. I pushed the linen cart ahead of me down the carpeted corridor. The wheels kept getting hung up in the high-low pile, and I struggled to keep the cart from lumbering into walls. The plan Ray Rawson and I had worked out was this. Rawson would call Laura's room from the house phone on the far side of the lobby, within view of the front desk. He'd claim to be the desk clerk, in receipt of a package that required her signature. He'd tell her he was just now going on his break, but the package would be waiting on the manager's desk. If she could come down as soon as possible, one of the other clerks would be happy to get it for her. If she asked to have it sent up, he'd inform her regretfully this was against hotel policy. Recently a package had been misdelivered, and the manager was now insisting the guests appear in person. While this was going on, I was to loiter in the corridor near her room, making careful note of the time she left. As soon as the down elevator doors closed behind her, I would let myself into 1236 with her key. Laura would reach the lobby where the desk clerk would search in vain for the non-existent package. Confusion, upset, and apologies forthcoming. Everyone would profess ignorance of both package and policy. Sorry for the inconvenience. As soon as the package surfaced, it would be sent up. Once she left the desk on her way upstairs again, Rawson would call the room and let the phone ring once. That would be my cue to get out if I was still there. Since I knew exactly where the duffel was located, it shouldn't take more than 10 seconds to snag the contents. By the time Laura emerged from the elevator on 12, I'd be heading down the fire stairs to the 8th floor again. There I'd change into my street clothes and grab my shoulder bag. I would meet Rawson in the lobby, and before Laura even realized that she'd been ripped off, we'd be on our way to the airport, where we'd get the next flight out. I wasn't at all bothered by the ethics of stealing money from thieves. It was the notion of getting caught made my heart go pity-pat. I positioned my cart 2 rooms away from Laura's door and checked my watch. Rawson was waiting to make his call at 10 o'clock, allowing me time to get myself set up. It was 9:58. I occupied myself with a load of towels, which I folded and refolded, wanting to be busily engaged when Laura Huckabee came out. The corridor was dead quiet, and the acoustics were such that I could hear the telephone begin to ring when he called her room. The phone was picked up after 2 rings, and a tidy silence ensued. I could feel my stomach churning with anticipation. Mentally, I rehearsed, picturing her trip down the hall, into the elevator, over to the desk, chat with the clerk, the search for the package, frustration and assurances, and back she'd come. I'd have at least a 5-minute window of opportunity, more than ample time for the task I'd assigned myself. I checked my watch again. 10:08. What was taking her so long? I thought she'd be wildly curious about the arrival of a package, especially one that required her signature. Whatever the delay, it was 10:17 before she emerged. I kept my face averted, avoiding her gaze as I picked up my clipboard and made random marks. She closed the door behind her and then caught sight of me. "Oh, hi. Remember me?" I looked up at her. "Yes, ma'am. How are you?" I said. I put the clipboard down and picked up a towel, which I folded in half. "Did you come across my key when you serviced the room last night?" She wore the usual heavy makeup, and her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, tied with a scarf of bright green chiffon. "No, ma'am, but if it's missing, you can get a duplicate at the front desk." I folded another towel and put it on the stack. "I guess I'll do that," she said. "Thanks. Have a good day." "You too." I studied Laura's backside as she moved toward the elevators. She wore a white cotton turtleneck under a dark green corduroy jumper that may or may not have been designed for maternity wear. The hemline was longer in the back than it was in the front. She tugged at the garment, which was bunching up around the middle. She wore her red high-top tennis shoes, and her tights today were dark green. If my suspicions were correct and she was the victim of spousal abuse, it might explain her tendency to keep herself covered up. I slid my hand into my pocket where her $5 tip was still neatly folded from the night before. That bill was the only flicker of recognition I'd netted in my guise as a char. I wished she hadn't seemed so friendly. I suddenly felt like a dog for what I was about to do. She rounded the corner. I set the towels aside and took out the key. There was a pause. I felt like I was waiting for a starter gun to go off. I heard the indicator ping as the elevator reached the floor, then the muffled sound of doors sliding shut again. I was already moving toward the door to 1236. I shoved the key in the lock, turned it, opened the door, and tagged the knob with a laminated maiden room sign, just in case she came back without warning. 10:18. I did a quick check to verify that both the room and the bathroom were empty as expected. I flipped the light on in the dressing area. Since last night, additional toiletries had been unpacked and arranged around the sink. I moved to the closet and opened the door. The duffel was right where I'd seen it before, with her handbag tucked beside it. I hauled the duffel out of the closet and propped it up on the counter. I did a superficial examination, making sure the bag wasn't booby-trapped in some way. The duffel was made of heavy-duty beige canvas, probably waterproof, with dark leather handles and a pocket on one side for magazines. There was a flap closure compartment on each end of the bag where smaller items could be tucked. I unzipped the main compartment and sorted through the contents at breakneck speed. Socks, flannel pajamas, clean underwear, pantyhose. I checked the compartment on either side, but both were empty. Nothing in the outside pocket. Maybe she'd removed the cash and put it someplace else. I checked the time. 10:19. I probably still had a good 3 minutes to go. I put the duffel back and picked up her handbag, riffling through the contents. Her wallet held a Kentucky driver's license, assorted credit cards, miscellaneous identification, and maybe $100 in cash. I put the handbag back beside the duffel. How much cash could we be talking about, and how much space could it occupy? Standing on tiptoe, I checked the closet shelf, which was bare to the touch. I felt inside her raincoat pockets, then slipped a hand into the pockets of the denim dress she'd worn, now hanging beside the raincoat. I tried the cabinet under the sink, but all it contained was the water pipes and a shut-off valve. I did a quick survey of the shower surround and the toilet tank. I went into the main room, where I slid open drawer after drawer. All were empty. Nothing in the TV cabinet, nothing in the bed table. The phone rang suddenly. Once. Then silence. My heart started banging. Laura Huckabee was on her way up. I was flat out of time. I moved to the desk and pulled out the pencil drawer, peering to see if there was something taped under it. I got down on my hands and knees and peered under the beds, then pulled the spread back and raised the edge of the mattress on the nearest of the two. Nope. I tried the other bed, extending my arm between the mattress and the box springs. I hauled myself up and smoothed the covers back in place. I searched the duffel again, rooting through the jumble of clothing, wondering what I'd overlooked. Maybe there was a second zippered compartment inside the first. Ah, to hell with it. I grabbed up the duffel and headed to the door. I snagged the made-in-room sign and pulled the door shut behind me. I heard the elevator indicator ping, and then the sound of the door sliding open. Hastily, I shoved the duffel under a pile of clean sheets and began to push the cart down the hall. Laura Huckabee passed me, walking rapidly. She had a room key in hand, so at least her trip down hadn't been a total waste. This time she didn't even look in my direction. She let herself into her room and shut the door with a bang. I shoved the cart into the alcove at the end of the hall, pulled out the duffel, and scurried toward the fire exit. I pushed my way into the stairwell and started down at a run, skipping every other step. If Laura Huckabee was at all suspicious, it wouldn't take her long to spot the subtle disarray. I pictured her heading straight to the closet, cursing her stupidity when she saw the duffel was missing. She'd have to know she'd been had. Whether she'd set up a stink or not would depend on how much nerve she had. If she'd been carrying a large amount of legitimate cash, why not take advantage of the hotel safe? Unless the booty itself was what Ray Rawson had lied about. I reached the 8th floor and pushed the door open, heading for 8:15. I pulled up short. A man in a business suit was standing in the hall outside my room. He turned when he caught sight of me. I caught a glimpse of the name tag pinned to his suit. The duffel suddenly seemed enormous and quite conspicuous. Why would a maid be toting a canvas bag of this sort? I moved automatically toward the utility alcove. My chest felt hot, and I was starting to hyperventilate. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched as he knocked on my door again. Casually, he checked the corridor in both directions, then took out a passkey and let himself into my room. Oh, God, now what? I put the duffel on a shelf in the linen room and put a stack of clean sheets on top of it. The sheets tumbled to the floor, and the duffel toppled with them. I gathered up the duffel and shoved it temporarily into an enormous laundry bag meant for dirty linen. I got down on my knees and began to refold sheets. I had to do something while I waited for the guy to get out of my room. I peered around the door. No sign of him, so I had to assume he was still in my room, nosing through my belongings. My shoulder bag was in the closet, and I didn't want him searching it, but I really didn't have a way to stop him, short of setting fire to the place. I heard the door to the fire exit open and close. Please, 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 God, don't let it be one of the real maids, I thought. Someone stepped into view. I looked up. Well, my prayers had been answered. It wasn't the maid. It was the security guard. I felt a flash of fear move up my frame, heat bringing color to my face. He was in his mid-40s, short hair, glasses, clean-shaven, overweight. In my opinion, he should have been doing sit-ups for the gut he sported. He stood there watching me fold a pillowcase. I smiled blankly. I felt like an actress in a play suffering acute stage fright. All the spit left my mouth and seeped out the other end.
May I ask what you're doing?
I was just straightening these sheets. Mrs. Spitz told me to check the linen supply up here. I struggled to my feet. Even in my guise as a lowly chambermaid, I didn't want him to tower over me. He stared at me carefully. The look in his eyes was flat, and his tone was a mix of authority and judgment.
Can I have your name?
Yes, I realized I'd better give him one. Katie, I'm new. I'm in training. Eileen and Bernadette are actually working this shift. I'm supposed to help, but I dropped these sheets. I tried to smile again, but my expression came closer to a simper. He studied me with calculation, apparently weighing the truth value of the statement I'd made. His gaze flicked down to my uniform.
Where's your name tag, Katie?
I put my hand across my heart like the Pledge of Allegiance. I couldn't think of a response.
I lost it. I'm supposed to get another one.
Mind if I verify that with Mrs. Spitz?
Sure, no problem. Go right ahead.
What's your last name?
He'd already taken out his walkie-talkie, and his thumb was moving toward the button. Beatty, like in Warren Beatty, I said without thinking. I realized, belatedly, my name was now Katie Beatty. I plowed right on. If you came up to find the manager, he's in 815. The woman he's looking for is on her way downstairs, I said. I pointed in the direction of 815. My hand was shaking badly, but he didn't seem to notice. He'd turned to glance down the corridor behind him.
Mr. Denton is up here?
Yes, at least I think that's him. I got the impression he was looking for that woman, but she just left.
What's the problem?
He didn't say. He lowered the walkie-talkie.
How long ago was this?
5 minutes. I was just getting off the elevator when she got on. He paused, staring at me as he reached back and secured his walkie-talkie on his belt. His gaze dropped to my feet and then came up again.
The shoes aren't regulation.
I looked down at my feet. Really? Nobody ever said anything to me.
If Mrs. Spitz sees those, you're going to get written up.
My whole face was aflame. Thanks, I'll remember that. He moved down the corridor. I stood there transfixed, longing to flee, reluctant to move for fear of calling attention to myself. He tapped on my door. A moment passed, and the door was opened a crack. The security officer conferred with the guy in my room. Then the guy in the suit came out and pulled my door shut behind him. The two men moved quickly down the hall toward the elevators. I waited until I heard the elevator ping, and then I retrieved the duffel from its hiding place. The elevator doors were barely closed when I double-timed down the hall, let myself into my room, and slid the chain into place. How long would it take before they figured out that Kinsey Milhone and the non-regulation maid without name tag were one and the same? I reached down and flipped my shoes off. I pulled the red tunic over my head, unzipped the uniform skirt, and stepped out of it. I leaned against the wall while I pulled on my crew socks. I grabbed my jeans and stepped into them, hopping off balance as I pulled them up. I tugged my turtleneck over my head, shoved my feet back in my shoes, and left the laces flopping loose. I opened the closet door. My handbag was still on the floor where I'd left it, but a glance was all it took to verify that the guy in the suit had been rooting around in it. Shitheel. I yanked the blazer off the hanger and shrugged myself into it. I did a quick survey of the room to make sure I hadn't left anything behind. I remembered the $5 tip in my uniform pocket and retrieved that. I picked up the duffel and started to let myself out. I went back, snatched the red uniform off the floor, and made a ball of it, shoving it into the zippered compartment of the duffel bag. If they searched again, why give them the satisfaction of finding it? I pulled the door shut behind me, then half-walked, half-trotted toward the fire stairs. I went down 8 flights of steps. When I reached the door to the lobby, I opened it a crack and looked out. A small group of businessmen seemed to be having an impromptu meeting in one of the conversational groupings. Papers had been spread out on the table. I peered around to the left. There was a couple conferring with the concierge who seemed to be holding a map of the area. There was no sign of Mr. Denton or the security guard. No sign of Ray Rawson either, for that matter. He'd said he'd meet me by the house phone, which I could plainly see across the lobby. The area was deserted, but too exposed for my taste. I looked to my right. There was a bank of pay telephones about 5 feet away, and beyond that, the lords and damsels. Across from me to the left was the entrance to the coffee shop. I left the relative safety of the stairwell and eased down the corridor and into the ladies' room. Two of the 5 stall doors were closed, but when I checked under the partitions, there were no feet in evidence. I locked myself in the handicapped stall, perched on the toilet seat, and tied my shoes. Then I emptied the duffel, shaking the contents out onto the floor. First, I checked the bag itself, peering into every pocket and crevice, sticking my fingers down into every corner. I thought I might find some kind of hidden compartment, but there didn't seem to be anything of the sort. I manipulated every seam, every brad, and every joining. I inspected each item of clothing I'd dumped out on the floor, folding and repacking the stolen uniform, a pair of cotton pajamas, 2 pairs of tights, T-shirts, tampons, 2 bras, and countless pairs of undies and socks. There was absolutely nothing there. I could feel my anxiety begin to mount. I'd followed this pointless piece of luggage across 3 states, operating on the assumption that it contained something worth pursuing. Now it looked like all I was ending up with was a pile of second-hand lingerie. What was I to tell Chester? He was going to be furious when I told him I'd flown all the way to Dallas for this. The man didn't have the money to send me barreling across the country on the track of cotton panties. I'd broken the law. I was flirting with jail. I'd risked both my license and my livelihood. I began shoving items back into the zippered compartment. Happily, the panties looked like they'd fit, and I could use a clean pair. I hesitated. Nah, probably not a good idea. If I were arrested for theft, it might be better if I weren't wearing the evidence on my butt. I emerged from the stall, trying to look nonchalant, instead of like some big-time fugitive underwear bounty hunter. I couldn't bring myself to abandon the duffel. Basically, I was still clinging to the notion that it represented some rare and priceless artifact instead of my ticket to the joint. I glanced left across the lobby toward the house phone, but there was still no sign of Ray. I planted myself at one of the public telephones. I fumbled in my blazer pocket, emptying the contents in my search for change. On the metal shelf, I laid out the movie receipt, the ballpoint, my $5 tip, 2 quarters, and the paperclip. I dropped one of the quarters in the coin slot and then put a call through to Chester in California, charging it to my telephone credit card. I got my quarter back and placed it with the first, idly rearranging the items for the calming effect. I didn't think Chester would be happy. I was hoping he'd be out, but the man himself picked up on the third ring.
Hello?
Hello, Chester. This is Kinsey.
Can you speak up? I can't hear you. Who is this?
I cupped my hand around the mouthpiece, turning my body away so I wouldn't be shouting my name across the lobby.
It's me, Kinsey, I hissed. I got the duffel, but there's nothing of significance in it.
Dead silence.
You're kidding.
No, actually I'm not. Either the goods were moved or there wasn't anything stolen in the first place.
Of course they stole something. They ripped the friggin' kick plate off the kitchen cabinet. Pappy probably hid cash.
Did you ever see any cash?
No, but that doesn't mean it wasn't there.
That's pure speculation. Maybe the guy busted in and didn't find anything. The duffel might have been empty. I began to rearrange the items on the shelf, placing one of the quarters over Lincoln's face on the $5 bill. On the quarter, George Washington looked naked, while on the bill, Lincoln was all dressed up in his Sunday suit. They must have caught George in the sauna with his hair pulled back. Chester, sounding cranky, said,
I don't get this. Why call me just to lay out a line of horseshit like this?
I thought you should get an update. It only seemed fair.
Fair? You think it's fair I spent all that money flying you to Dallas for nothing? I expected results.
Wait a minute. So far you haven't spent a dime. I've spent the money. You're supposed to pay me back. I uncapped my ballpoint pen and gave Lincoln a mustache, which made his nose look smaller. I'd never paid attention to what a hooter he had.
Pay you back for what? Air and sunshine? Forget it.
Come on, we made a decision that turned out to be wrong.
Then why should I pay? I'm not going to pay for your incompetence.
Chester, believe me, I'm earning my keep. I could get my license yanked for half the things I've done. I'm not even allowed to do business in this state. I put the 2 quarters over opposite corners of the $5 bill to anchor it.
That's your problem, not mine. I wouldn't have agreed if I'd known you were off on some wild goose chase.
Well, neither would I. That's the chance we took. You knew as much as I did going in, I said. To amuse myself, I wrote a bad word on the front of the $5 bill. It was the only way I could think of to keep from screaming at him.
To hell with it. You're fired.
I heard him say, God damn it, to himself, just as he banged the phone down in my ear. I made a face at the dead receiver and then rolled my eyes. I hauled up the phone book and started looking up the reservation number for American Airlines. It was embarrassing to admit this had all been for nothing, but I couldn't see what good it would do to stay in Dallas. I'd made a mistake. I'd known at the outset my actions were impulsive. I'd been operating on the best information I had, and if my judgment turned out to be misguided, there was nothing I could do about it now. I noticed I was busy defending myself, but I really couldn't help it in the wake of Chester's disgruntlement. Who could blame the man? I picked up the five and held it closer, looking at the fine details. Paper currency has a baroque assortment of shaded names and numbers, lacy scrollwork, and official seals. Now that was weird. Since when was Henry Morgenthau Secretary of the Treasury? And who was this guy Julian, whose eensy-teensy signature was so impossible to read? Just to the right of Lincoln's portrait, it said, Series 1934A. I dug in my handbag and pulled out my wallet, checking the few bills I carried. The only other five I had in my possession was a Series 1981 Buchanan-Reagan. The $1 bills were 1981 Buchanan-Reagans and 1981A Ortega Reagan, with a couple of brand-new 1985 Ortega Bakers thrown in. A 20 and a 10 seemed to be the same vintage. If I wasn't mistaken, it meant the $5 tip Laura Huckabee had given me was a bill dating back to 1934. Didn't that indicate she was busy spending money from a cache of old bills? Surely she didn't simply happen to have a bill like that in her possession. I put the phone book down, abandoning the notion of getting back on a plane. Maybe all was not lost. I picked up the duffel and moved forward, scanning the expanse of lobby within view. The five businessmen leaned toward each other, passing the pages of some report between them. As usual in such a group, one fellow seemed to command the attention of the others. Behind me, the door opened abruptly, and before I could turn around, I was snagged by the elbow and pulled into the stairwell.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
Chapter 11.
Where the hell have you been?
I turned, astonished. It was Ray, his badly bruised face about 6 inches from mine. He'd removed the tape from his nose, but it still looked like his nostrils were packed with cotton. His skin smelled medicinal, the sort of aftershave you'd sport in an emergency room, composed of equal parts rubbing alcohol, adhesive tape, and suturing material. He still clutched me with his injured hand, his splinted fingers held stiffly. Where have I been? Where have you been? Our voices seemed to ricochet up the stairwell like a flock of shrieking birds. Both of us glanced upward and lowered our tones to rasping whispers. Ray urged me into the cul-de-sac formed by the final flight of steps where it dead-ended at the wall.
Christ, those guys are on to you, he hissed. Some yo-yo with a walkie-talkie's been giving me the third degree. I'm waiting by the house phone, and he asks if I'd mind stepping into the office. What was I supposed to do? He knows who you are, and he wants to know what you're doing here.
Why'd he ask you?
He'd been checking around. The waitress must have told him she'd seen us together. I wasn't hard to spot, with a mug like this. I told him you were a private investigator working undercover on a case I wasn't at liberty to discuss.
Who did he think you were? A cop? I told him I was part of a witness protection program, being moved to another state. I had to talk like this was all very hush-hush, life-or-death stuff. They couldn't have believed you. How'd you get away? They don't give a shit who I am. They just want me out of here. I said I'd go up to the room and get my things. They escorted me to the elevator, and as soon as they left, I turned around and came down. Is that the duffel? Give it here. I jerked it out of his reach. Listen, you piker, do you swear on a stack of Bibles you've told me the truth? This is cash we're looking for, not drugs or diamonds or stolen documents, right? It's money, I swear. You didn't find it? I didn't find a thing. How much are we talking about? $8,000. Maybe a little less by now. That's all? Come on, it's a lot when you don't have a dime, which I don't. Somehow I got the impression it was more, I said. Our voices had started to reverberate again. He put a finger to his lips. Where'd the money come from? I whispered hoarsely. I'll tell you later. Let's see if we can find a way out of here. There's a service corridor below this one, but you can't access it from here, I said. What about the floor above? I don't think so. He started up the steps, but I grabbed his arm. Wait a minute, slow down, we need a plan. We need the cash, he corrected, before hotel security catches up with us again. Maybe this Huckabee woman left the money with the manager. She couldn't. I was standing in the same line when she checked in. She didn't deposit any valuables. I'd have seen her do that. Then where is it? She's not going to let the money out of her sight. If we figure out where she's got it, you can snag it and run. Oh, I can. That's nice. What about you? I'm speaking figuratively, he said. Well, the cash isn't in her room because I've searched.
Then she must have it with her.
She does not. I told you that. Ah! I heard the sound an idea makes when your brain ignites. A tiny implosion, like spontaneous combustion at the base of your skull.
Wait a minute. I got it. I think I know where it is. Come with me.
I knocked on Laura Huckabee's door. There was a pause. She was probably checking through the spy hole to see who it was. Ray was standing against the wall to the left of the door with a look of suffering on his face.
I know how Gilbert got my release date, he said dully. I didn't want to tell you unless I had to.
Hush, I said under my breath. I couldn't figure out what his problem was, aside from the obvious. He'd been curiously reluctant to come up here with me, suggesting all kinds of reasons I should do it myself. I'd been adamant. For one thing, if we were caught, we could act like we were just leaving. For another, now that Chester was pissed off, I didn't want to take sole responsibility. As before, Laura opened the door a crack, leaving the chain in place. I held up the duffel.
Hi, it's me. I'm off duty. I found this in the hall.
Is that mine?
I think so. Wasn't this sitting in your closet last night?
How'd it get out there?
Beats me. I spotted it in passing and thought I'd knock, I said. It is yours, isn't it?
She studied it briefly. Just a minute, I'll check.
She left the door ajar, still secured by the chain, while she moved into the dressing area and opened the closet door. Ray and I exchanged a look. I knew she wasn't going to find her duffel, but I waited dutifully, playing out the charade. She returned to the door, her expression perplexed.
I guess it is mine.
It was clear she didn't want to trust me, but what could she do?
From her point of view, she'd been subjected to inexplicable occurrences. A lost key, a missing package, now the wandering duffel.
I can leave it out here. You want me to do that?
No, that's all right.
She closed the door and slipped the chain off its track. She opened the door again, just wide enough for the duffel, holding her hand out as if to take it from me. I put a hand around the edge of the door, effectively preventing her from closing it. She seemed startled by the gesture and said, "Hey," irritably. I hoped my smile was reassuring. "Mind if I come in? We need to talk." I pushed the door inward.
"Get away," she said, pushing back.
We grappled with the door, but Ray had moved into the picture by then, and after a mute struggle on her part, she relinquished control. She'd begun to realize that something was dreadfully wrong.
I'm Kinsey Milhone, I said as we stepped into the room. This is my friend Ray.
She backed up a step, taking in Ray's bruised and swollen face.
What is this?
We called a meeting about the money, I said. Just between you, me, and him.
She pivoted, moving rapidly toward the bed table, where she snatched up the receiver.
Ray intercepted her and banged down the button before she could press zero.
Take it easy. We just want to talk to you, he said.
He moved the receiver from her hand and dropped it in the cradle. Who are you? What is this, some kind of shakedown?
Not at all, I said. We followed you from California. Your friend Gilbert stole some money, and Ray here wants it back.
Her eyes fixed on me and then jumped to him, comprehension dawning.
You're Ray Rawson.
That's right.
She raised a hand rapidly as if to slap him in the face. Ray blocked the move and caught the blow on his arm. He grabbed her wrist with his good hand.
Don't do that, he said.
Get your fucking hands off me.
Just give us the money and we'll leave you alone.
It isn't yours. It belongs to Gilbert.
Ray shook his head.
I'm afraid not. Money belongs to me and a guy named Johnny Lee. Johnny died 4 months ago, so I'm passing his share along to his son and grandson. Gilbert tried to rip us off.
You goddamn shit, that's not true. The money's his and you know it. You're the one who blew the whistle. His brother died because of you.
That's bullshit. Is that what he said?
Well, yes. He told me it was some kind of sting and it was all set up. You tipped off the cops and Donnie was killed in the shootout, she said.
Wait a minute, gang. What's going on? I said.
Ray seemed unruffled, ignoring me altogether in his focus on her.
He lied to you, baby. Gilbert sold you a bill of goods. He probably had to do that to get you to participate, right? Because if you knew the truth, you wouldn't help. I hope.
You asshole. He told me you'd try to do this, twist the truth until it suited your purposes.
You want the truth? I'll tell you. You want to hear what went down?
She put her hands to her ears as if to shut him out.
I don't have to hear it from you. Gilbert told me what happened.
I raised my hand.
Would one of you stop and tell me what this is about? Do you two know each other?
Not exactly, Ray said.
He turned to look at her, and the two of them locked eyes. Ray's gaze flicked back to mine.
This is my daughter. I haven't seen her in years.
She flung herself at him, banging with her fists on his chest.
You are such a fuck,
she said, and promptly burst into tears. I looked from one to the other. My mouth did not really fall open, but that's what it felt like. Ray gathered her into his arms.
I know, baby, I know, he murmured, patting at her. I feel so bad about everything.
It probably took another 5 or 6 minutes for Laura's tears to taper off. Her face was mashed against his shoulder, her bulky belly making the embrace seem awkward. Ray rested his battered cheek against her tangled hair, most of which had come loose now, hanging down in dark auburn clumps. Ray was nearly humming with unhappiness at the sound of her misery, which she managed to express with a childlike lack of inhibition. Neither was accustomed to the physical contact, and my suspicion was that the fleeting connection by no means represented resolution. If their estrangement was lifelong, it would take more than a hallmark moment to set it right. In the meantime, I blocked any thought of my cousin Tasha and my estrangement from Grand. I went to the window and looked out at the barren stretch of Texas countryside. I felt about as arid. Here, as in California, the liberal application of imported water was the only means by which the land was being reclaimed from the desert. At least I understood now why he hadn't wanted to come up here. He must have dreaded the moment when the two of them would meet, especially once he understood how Gilbert Hayes had used her. Why is it that life's most touching moments are so often the most depressing? Behind me, finally, the weeping seemed to be diminishing. There was some murmuring between them that I politely tuned out. When I turned back, the two were seated side by side on one of the double beds. Laura's tears had streaked through the many layers of makeup, bringing ancient bruises to the surface. It was clear she'd recently suffered a black eye. Her jaw was tinted a drab green, washing out to yellow around the edges, colors repeated in the riper bruises of her father's face. Odd to think the same man had beaten both.
He studied her face, and the effect wasn't lost on him. A look of pain filled his eyes.
He do that to you? Because if he did, I'll kill him, I swear to God.
It wasn't like that, she said.
It wasn't like that. Bullshit.
Her eyes flooded again. I moved into the dressing area and grabbed some tissues from the dispenser. When I returned to the bed, Ray took the wad and passed them over to her. She blew her nose and then looked at me with resentment.
You're not really the maid, she said resentfully. You didn't even do the sheet corners right.
I'm a private investigator.
I knew this hotel wouldn't have turned down service. I should have trusted my instincts.
Ain't that the truth, I said. I sat down on the other bed. Now, would one of you fill me in? Ray turned to me with an expectant look.
Wait a minute. What's the deal?
The deal?
I don't know where the money is. I thought it was up here someplace.
Ah, the money. Why don't you ask her?
Me? I don't have it. What are you talking about?
Yes, you do. I reached over to Laura's belly and knocked on the mound. The thudding noise was not what you'd expect of warm maternal flesh. She smacked my hand away, incensed.
Stop that!
Ray stared.
It's in her stomach? Like, up her butt?
Not quite. The belly's phony.
How'd you figure that?
She has tampons in the duffel. If she were pregnant, she wouldn't need 'em. It's a girl thing, I replied.
I am pregnant. What's the matter with you? The baby's due in January, the 16th to be exact.
In that case, pull up your dress so we can watch it kick.
I don't have to do that. I can't believe you suggested it.
Ray, I'm telling you, she's got the money in some kind of harness. That's how she got it on the plane without it showing up on security. 8,000 in a duffel, they might have asked too many questions.
That's ridiculous. There's no law that says you can't transport cash across state lines.
There is when the money's stolen, I said in my best nanny nanny boo boo tone.
Really, the two of us were like sisters squabbling over everything.
Come on, ladies, please.
I doubled up my fist. You want me to punch her in the stomach? It'd be a good test.
Oh, for God's sake, this is none of your business.
Yes, it is. Chester hired me to find the money, and I've done just that.
I do not have the money, she said, enunciating every single word.
I pulled my fist back.
All right, God damn it. It's in a canvas vest that hooks on in front. I hope you're satisfied.
I loved the indignation, like I was the one who'd been lying to her.
Well, that's great. So let's see it. I'm curious what it looks like.
Ray, would you tell her to get away from me?
Ray looked at me.
Just drop it. This is silly. I thought you said you wanted to hear the story.
I do.
Then cut the nonsense and let's get on with it.
He looked back at his daughter.
You start. I'd like to hear Gilbert's version. He's saying what, that I betrayed the others?
Let me wash my face first. I feel awful, she said.
Her nose was red, her eyes puffy with emotion. She got up and went into the dressing area where she ran water in the sink.
Your daughter? You could have told me, I said.
Ray avoided my gaze like a dog that's done potty on the good rug. When Laura returned, he let her sit on the bed while he fetched the desk chair and pulled it over closer. Her complexion, free of makeup, showed all the splotchy imperfections you'd expect. She glanced once at Ray, her expression faltering. She picked up a twist of tissue, which she wrapped around her index finger. Given center stage, she seemed oddly reluctant.
Gilbert says there was a bank robbery back in 1941.
That's right.
I flashed a look at him.
It is?
There were five of you all together. You, Gilbert, his brother Donnie, the guy you mentioned.
Johnny Lee, Ray supplied.
Right, him and a man named McDermid.
Actually, there were six of us, two McDermids, Frank and Darryl, Ray amended.
She shrugged, accepting the correction, which apparently didn't affect her understanding of the incident.
Gilbert says you tipped off the cops and they showed up in the middle of the robbery. There was a shootout and his brother Donnie was killed. So was McDermid and a policeman. The money vanished, but Gilbert was convinced you and Johnny knew where it was hidden.
Johnny was in prison for 2 years, and when he got out, he disappeared. Gilbert had no way to trace him, so he waited till you got out and followed you. And sure enough, there it was. All Gilbert took was his share. Well, I guess his brother's share, too. He figures you and Johnny had the use of it for years, so whatever was left belongs to him by rights.
Could I just clarify one thing? I said to Laura.
Sure.
I take it your mother was the one who told you when Ray was getting out of prison?
She nodded.
She mentioned it to me. Gilbert had already told me what happened, and I was furious. I mean, it was bad enough my father had been in prison all his life, but to find out he'd betrayed all his friends, that was the lowest of the low.
Baby, I have to say this. I don't know what your relationship is with Gilbert, but hasn't it occurred to you he only got close to you so he could get to me?
No, absolutely not. You don't know that, she said.
Look at the facts. I mean, it only stands to reason, he said. Didn't he ask about me early on? Maybe not by name, but just the family situation, blah, 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 your dad and stepdad, things like that.
So what if he did? Everybody asks things like that early on.
Well, doesn't it strike you as odd? Here, just coincidentally, it turns out the two of us pulled a job together 40-some-odd years back.
Not really. Gilbert knew Paul from work. He's my stepdad, she said in an aside to me. I guess Paul must have mentioned the name Rawson in some context.
Oh, yeah, right, Ray said with acid. Like your stepfather sits around and bullshits about me with the guys at work.
What difference does it make? Laura said. Somehow it came up. Maybe it was karma.
Ray's expression was impatient. He didn't buy that for a minute. But he made that rolling hand gesture that said, "Let's get on with it."
I'm not going to keep talking if you act like that, Ray, she said primly. You asked for my side, and that's what I'm trying to tell you, okay?
Okay, you're right, I'm sorry. But let me ask you this.
I'm not saying I know all the details, she interjected.
I understand that. I'm just asking about the logic. Listen, in the gospel according to Gilbert, if what he says is true, then how come I spent 40 years in prison? If I blew the whistle, I'd have made a deal. I never would have served a day. Or I'd have pled down and done county jail time just to make it look good.
Laura was silent, and I could see her struggling to come up with an explanation that made sense.
I don't really know. He never went into that.
Well, think about it.
I know Gilbert never served much time, she said tentatively.
Yeah, but he was 17. He was still a juvenile, and this was his first offense. Johnny always figured it was the younger McDermott, Darryl. Frank was too much of a stand-up guy. Darryl was the one who testified against us in court and ended up doing less than a year himself. You want to know why? Because he turned us in, and in exchange they let him plead down to some lesser charge. Gilbert wants to blame me because the little fuck is greedy and wants to justify picking off all the loot for himself. By the way, you haven't said. Are you two married?
We live together.
You live together. That's nice. A year, couple years?
About that, she said.
Don't you have any idea what he's like?
Laura said nothing. Judging from the bruises, she knew plenty about Gilbert.
I don't believe he lied. You're the liar.
Why don't you reserve judgment until you hear my side of it?
I held a hand up.
Ray, am I going to be surprised by what comes next? Is this going to be like big news and piss me off?
His smile was sheepish.
Why?
Because I'm just wondering how many versions of the story you tell. This is number 3 by my count.
This is it. Last one. Swear to God.
I glanced at Laura.
The man does lie through his teeth, or what's left of them.
I haven't lied, he said. I might have failed to mention a couple things.
A shootout with the cops? What else have you failed to mention? I'd be fascinated, I said.
I can do without the sarcasm.
I can do without the bullshit. You said Gilbert was a former cellmate.
I had to tell you something, he said. Come on, this is not easy. I kept my mouth shut 40 years. Johnny Lee and I swore we'd never give anything away.
The problem is, he died without giving me some vital information.
I'm going to get comfortable, I said. I leaned over and pulled the pillows out from under the bedspread and propped them up against the headboard, kicking my shoes off before I settled into place. This was like a bedtime story, and I didn't want to miss it.
You comfy? He said. I'm terrific.
Johnny dreamed up this scheme and talked me into going in with him. You have to understand a little background on this. I hope you don't mind.
If you're going to tell the truth for a change, take your time, I said.
Ray got to his feet and began to pace. I'm trying to think of how far back to go. Let's try this. Ohio River flooded in the winter of 1937. I guess it started raining sometime in January and the river just kept going up. Eventually, there was something like 12,000 acres underwater all up and down the Ohio River Valley. At the time, Johnny was in state reformatory down in Lexington. Well, the inmates began to riot. 60 of them busted out of there, and Johnny Lee was one. He gets as far as Louisville and disappears in the confusion. He starts helping with flood relief. He paused, looking from Laura to me.
Just be patient, he said, because you have to understand how this scheme was set up in the first place.
Fine with me, she said. He looked at me.
Go right ahead, I said.
Okay. Anyway, thousands of volunteers poured into the city, and nobody asked questions. From what Johnny told me, you pitched in, nobody cared who you were or where you came from. So he's rowing through the West End, saving people off of rooftops. The water's up to the second story in most places. I've seen pictures of this, as high as traffic lights. Damnedest thing you've ever seen. Johnny made this boat out of 4 barrels and some crates, and he's paddling right down the middle of the street. He had the time of his life. He even stuck around afterwards and helped with the cleanup, which is how he dreamed up this heist.
Lot of buildings collapsed. I mean, the whole downtown was underwater for weeks on end, and when the river receded, they put crews in there repairing anything that got broke. Johnny was smart. He knew all kinds of things. He told them he'd done construction, so they put him to work. Anyway, while he's crawling around this basement one day, he realizes he's looking at the underside of a bank. Electrical power's been out for days, so a lot of storm sewers have broken, and all this water's flowing past the foundation. There's this crack up the wall that he's supposed to fix. He puts together this patch job, wouldn't fool a pro, but there's no one around. Everybody's too busy to pay attention to him. So he tells him it's fixed when he hasn't done a thing except cover it up. He even signs off the inspection with forged signatures. I mean, it's not like there was anyone to double-check his work. By the time the two of us meet up, this is now 4 years later. Back then, big vaults were poured in place using number 5 rebar, which is 5/8 diameter, 4 inches on center, several layers offset. Understand, it's not like I'm the expert. I learned all this from him. This particular vault was constructed during the Depression, some kind of public works project, so you can imagine how well it was put together in the first place.
Vault like that, you can force entry if you got the tools and the time. He said it had always been at the back of his mind, but he knew he needed help once it came time, which is where I come in.
Johnny starts working on the foundation with this masonry bit. Nights and weekends, he goes in through the basement of the building next door and attacks the substructure. It probably takes him a month, but he's finally right up against the floor of the vault. Nowadays, this shit is all done with high-tech equipment, but in the old days, a successful bank job was the result of pure grit and hard work. It took patience and skill. Johnny figured the alarm system was tougher than the vault. At that point, we had to bring in some other guys because we needed the help. Johnny'd apprenticed with a locksmith, so he'd studied all the manuals and knew the specs by heart. But we needed an alarm man to dismantle the alarms. I'd been in jail with a guy I thought we could trust. That was Donnie Hayes, and he brought in his brother Gilbert. Like she said, Donnie's dead now, and Gilbert I got to thank for this. He held up his bruised and bandaged hand. I saw Laura's focus shift, and she exchanged a look with me. It apparently hadn't occurred to her before that Gilbert had done the damage to Ray Rawson's face. Johnny pulled in another couple of guys named McDermott. I think they were cousins he'd done some time with down in Lexington. Donnie Hayes defeated the alarm, and we went to work with the torches and the sledgehammers, pounding away like crazy until we finally busted through. Johnny started drilling safe deposit boxes while the rest of us set to work cleaning out the loot while he popped the boxes and dumped the contents. "Wait a minute. Who's Farley? How does he fit into this?" I asked.
"Gilbert's nephew," Laura replied. "The three of us came out to the coast together."
"Oh, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead." Anyway, we had us a regular bucket brigade tossing cash and jewelry out of safe deposit boxes, stuffing the goodies into canvas bags, then hand over hand down through the hole and out to the car waiting in the alley. We're working like dogs, and everything seems to be going as planned, until suddenly the cops show up and all hell breaks loose. This gun battle breaks out, in the course of which Frank McDermott and Donnie Hayes were both killed, along with this cop. I was hot-blooded in those days, and I fired the shot that killed the cop. Gilbert was captured, and so was Daryl McDermott. I heard later Daryl died in some accident, but I never had that confirmed.
"You and Johnny weren't captured?" I asked.
He shook his head.